After Herod died, an angel of the Lord appeared in a dream to Joseph in Egypt and said, get up, take the child and his mother and go to the land of Israel, for those who were trying to take the child's life are dead. So I got up, took the child and his mother and went to the land of Israel. But when he heard that Archelaus was reigning in Judea in place of his father Herod, he was afraid to go there. Having been warned in a dream, he withdrew to the district of Galilee, and he went and lived in a town called Nazareth. So was fulfilled what was said through the prophets, that he would be called a Nazarene. So in all of my thinking and understanding of Joseph, Jesus' earthly father, I always saw him as a man of order. I always saw him as a man who thought things through. And part of the reason for that is when Joseph hears that Mary is expecting, he did things orderly. He had a plan. So he always struck me as a man who wanted to follow one thing after another. He was a man who had, he understood his responsibilities. In what I just read this morning, you see Joseph, this organized man, being motivated and moved by dreams. So we see a number of events that took place in this story. So first we have the visit of the Magi. And then following that, there were three events precipitated by Herod's response to what he heard. So these three events are, first is the flight to Egypt. So there's the panic and the crisis of fleeing in the middle of the night. Joseph gets up and protects his family based on a dream. And he goes to Egypt. Following that, you have the pain of being far from home. We don't know how long they were in Egypt. There's the scriptures are silent. We don't know if it was months, if it was years. We don't know. So there was a time that they needed to be away from home. So think about it. This is a young mom, young family, probably not exactly what you want for your new child to be. Where's the joy in this? Now they're distant, they're far away. And then the third event, the tragic event, the killing of the innocents. On the heels of the visit of the Magi, you have this killing of the innocents, of the children. Where's the joy in that? Where's the joy in that? And in all of this, you have Joseph being motivated and moved by his dreams. Right? Joseph's first dream in Matthew tells him not to abandon Mary. His second dream, an angel tells Joseph to take Mary and Jesus to Egypt. Third dream, he's told that to be a refuge in the land and head back. And then the fourth dream is, well, instead of going to this place, go to the next one. Now, again, the OCD in me, I wouldn't do so well in that. That would be a lot of crisis, a lot of heartache. But embodied in this whole story, embodied in these dreams, you constantly have this underlying message of trust, believe, and follow. And then with every dream, you have the words, and so was fulfilled, or as was prophesied. But the comfort I get out of this is this reminder that Messiah was born in the time of a very chaotic political situation. And this was no surprise in prophecy and no surprise to God the Father. In all of these instances, you have Joseph doing what a father will do for his family, simply following in obedience. Here's a dream, I'm going to follow. I have a dream, I'm going to get up in the middle of the night in the crisis of fleeing, and I'm going to follow. We get into a foreign land as a refugee. I have a dream. I'm simply going to follow. I have a dream. I'm simply going to follow. In the midst of chaos, is there contentment in here? I think there probably was. I think we see it in the evidence of the way Joseph continued to follow. So when we think of joy, we often confuse joy with peace and tranquility and the absence of disarray. And I think in Joseph's example, we see something very different. Right on the heels of this best night ever, you have heartache and pain and chaos. You see, the holly jolly Christmas, the most wonderful time of the year, was jolted awake by the panic of a sudden crisis, the pain of being far from home, and the pain of unspeakable loss. See, Joseph models unwavering obedience. As peculiar as this situation has become, Joseph obeys without complaint. One commentator simply says, he knows nothing except the next step of the journey, but he takes that step in simple, humble obedience. And maybe in that, he discovers a little bit of contentment. I don't know where your journey is. As we speak of joy today and what your situation might be, maybe Joseph can give you a little bit of encouragement. And remember that when we follow, it is not a surprise to the one who put the universe together. Because as was prophesied, as was fulfilled, that runs parallel to all of Joseph's dreams. So this morning, as we spend a little bit of time together sharing around the tables, we do have a question. Where did I go here? I wanted you to think about it a little bit earlier, so I'm going to have you think about that a little bit and share with it. The question is there a special Christmas tradition that you practice now or that you remember from your childhood? Is there maybe an event, or maybe there's a book, or maybe there's a movie, something that you just reminds you every year? Maybe it's a special Christmas food or a baking. I've asked kids this a couple of times. You know, think of the smells of Christmas, the sounds of Christmas, the sights. What are those things that just evoke that special memory inside of you? Maybe a decoration or a centerpiece, or I think I got your juices flowing. So what we're going to do is we're going to take some time. So we do have coffee. If you don't have coffee yet, you're welcome to go get some. There's coffee and tea over at the counter. While we do that, we'll bring some squares and put them on your table. So what we'd like you to do is just take some time to greet and welcome each other. Make sure you know everybody's name around your table at least. And then you can get some, come back, and then take some time. We'll leave the question up and just take some time to share. What is it that makes Christmas that special for you?
So let me talk this morning a little bit about this concept that Dave's introduced about how in the world you live joy, especially in the middle of chaos. And Dave did an excellent job kind of painting for you the reality of life and the fact that sometimes we make the Christian life sound a bit like a euphemism, that it's all sunshine and roses. You know, accept Christ and you'll never have a bad day in your life. That's not the gospel. And that's certainly not what we experience day by day. There is something deep and meaningful that happens inside of us that changes us in order to cope with life. But this side of the grave, life will not be perfect. Life will not all be happiness. There will be much suffering. There'll be much disappointment. There's going to be much grief. Light writes white. Can you see that? Barely, eh? Light writes white. Anybody ever heard that expression? Any idea what that means? Light writes white. It's kind of a derogatory statement that artists use to talk about the state of mind you have to be in order to produce good art. So when you're a writer or a poet or an artist or a sculptor, what the argument goes is sort of like this: you need darkness in order to be a good artist. They literally will say, so when you're taking classes and you're taking the philosophy of art and you're trying to figure out how to be the best you can be, they say that the best artists are the ones that speak out of pathos, hopelessness, out of all the bad stuff that happens in life. It's brokenness, it's disappointment, it's hatred, it's being looked down on, it's having your life be so messed up and so miserable that out of that turmoil, out of the guts of ugliness, you produce these amazing works of art. And so the idea that light writes white is a put-down. It says if everything is right in your life, full of lightness, you're going to write nothing but bland stuff that nobody cares about. You're going to create artist work that nobody's going to enjoy. If all is well, then you have nothing to say. That's how the argument goes. I think that has more to say about humanity than it really has to say about the beauty of art. You guys were sharing some traditions around the table. Anybody celebrate this? I know you're sitting there going, celebrate it? I can't even say it. What the world is that? Yola Boca Flood. Yola Boca Flood. Yola Boca Flood. Yeah, you practice that, eh? That's a happy word. In 1944, when Iceland gained its independence from Denmark, one of the things that was the result of World War II was there was very little paper around. There was a paper shortage. And particularly up in Iceland, they treasured and valued anything in book form because there was so little around, and people started sharing books. And the other thing that happened was that soon after this, a lot of book launchings came early in November, December, and sort of new book lists were published for the coming year. And Icelandic community picked up on that, and there was a festival that they started to share that all these new book lists came out for all the books that were going to be published in the coming year. And people would started just naturally purchasing some of those books and then sharing them in the community. And so that actually became a festival. So Yola Bokaflud becomes the festival. It really means a flood of Christmas books. Now, that may say something about the community of Iceland, because this tradition, as it is practiced now, means that on Christmas Eve, you would give your loved ones a book, and they would give you books. And then on Christmas Eve, you would have your meal together, and then everybody retires to their favorite chair around the big roaring fire and starts reading. And all you do is you grab your favorite drink, and they even have a non-alcoholic Jokaflugur drink that everybody drinks, or you could just have a plain old coffee. But people will sit around for the rest of Christmas Eve, not playing games, right? Not watching a TV movie, but reading together, reading the books that they just gave each other. What an interesting tradition that is. Out of that comes a lot of contemplation, a lot of inward thinking. The Icelandic community is very proud of the fact that the average person in Iceland reads 8 books a year. You may think that 8 doesn't sound like much, but in the U.S., it's 2. In Canada, the average is under 1 book a year that's read from cover to cover. Now, of course, everybody says, I just get the first paragraph, the middle paragraph, and the last paragraph from Google. I've read the book. Right? Who needs to read all that extra stuff in the middle? Somebody will usually summarize it and tell you what's in there. Curious thing about our brains is that it's easier to be sad than glad. Scientists aren't exactly sure why that is, but when they see the brain firing and you actually show people things that make them happy versus things that make them sad, sadness fires up in our brains way quicker than gladness. Brains come alive with images. So if you show someone a picture of somebody starving versus a picture of somebody that is celebrating a birthday, the brain lights up faster and more intensely around sad events than it does around gladness. All that to say that our brains are wired and warped We always say warped as Christians because of the fact that we can't live in the freedom of how we were created because of sin. Our brains are wired and warped to focus on all that is wrong with the world. And then as Christians, we say we're also living under assault from three enemies of the soul, the world, the flesh, and the devil. And that makes for a lot of focus, and it's easier to focus on sadness. Another way to put it is this. It only takes 3 seconds to negatively imprint your brain with something. So if you see something, an image, for 3 seconds, it's imprinted, and you can relive that event. It'll cause you to suffer again and again and again if you see something negative. 3 seconds is all it takes. The brain is like it's on Teflon. It takes, for positive, it's way different. Brain on flypaper, bam, sticks. 3 seconds, boom, negative is right there. Takes 14 seconds to positively imprint. Now, one of the things that if you struggle a lot with depression and a lot of negative thoughts, one of the ways that you can help yourself is to take 14 seconds or more to stare at something or look at something or read something that is encouraging. In other words, you've got to stop yourself and stay in the moment. If you do this, you'll get to the end of the day and it's the negative that will overtake you because it only takes 3 seconds. You have to actually pause your brain and stop it in order to get a positive imprint. You think how often the psalmist says to us that we need to take stop. We need to do something and we need to do it purposely. The Lord is good, right? It'll make that as a statement. And then we're told to enjoy Him in that state. Rejoice, and again I say rejoice. Do it again. Be thankful in all things, always. It's always a cumulative thing. Whenever the positive is mentioned, it's like you have to get on a treadmill and you have to do it again and again and again and again and again and again and again to get the full effect. That's one of the great songs that we sing at Christmas time. And it is filled with imagery that is designed to stick in your head. You know, to us, those are just words of a song. But this was carefully crafted to make you think, no more let sins and sorrows grow, nor thorns infest the ground. That is a labor-intensive couplet, right? You poets out there, right? There is a lot of industry. There's a lot of work. Don't let sins and sorrows grow, or thorns infest your ground. Grab that hoe. Grab that shovel, grab that cultivator, grab that rototiller. That's what I meant, rotator. Now I'm doing battle bots. He rules the world with truth and grace and makes the nations prove the light of His righteousness and the wonders of His love. There's a tremendous amount of thought that goes into each of these couplets. Is it denial, wishful thinking, Christian escapism? What's going on here that God is constantly getting us to refocus on the positive? Dave read you the story of Luke chapter 2 and how much is going on in there. Everything from the registry in their own town, going from Nazareth to Galilee to Bethlehem. You got the shepherds out in the field. You got the angels, heavenly host. You got people hurrying off to see Mary and Joseph at the manger. The shepherds coming and joining that. And there's this huge scene. And in the middle of all that, there's these punctuated statements. One of them is, don't be afraid. Well, one of the keys to appreciating joy as Christ brings it into your life is that if you have a lot of fear in your life, it's going to always try and cry out joy. Fear is one of the great poisons to joy. You would have thought it was sadness, but it's not true. In fact, the psalmist can write amazingly happy stuff while being utterly sad. In the Psalms, you see gloom and doom and sadness, and yet he writes magnificent tributes to how his soul feels about being led by a sovereign God. It's not sorrow. It's not sadness. It's not your everyday life circumstances that are going to rob you of joy. It's fear. What are you afraid of? And those things become soul-sucking, and they suck the joy right out of you. It's funny that we're told about a king and a kingdom. The gospel is put in very different terms than Paul does. And by the time the gospel is sort of analyzed and sort of boiled down, maybe 150 years later, it's very different than what it was when the angels came and said, good news, good tidings. All it meant to those people was a king and a kingdom. Later on, when we get Paul adding his writings, now we say all kinds of things. But the kingdom of God is now and not yet, we discover. It's about what is and what is to come. And so for the people there, it was very simple. Paul later on puts all the accoutrements of faith to it, and so we get salvation by grace through faith alone. That becomes the signature move of the gospel. That was not what it was that first night with Mary and Joseph, and it's not what it was for another 60 years. As people were chewing on the good news, it was that the Messiah came. They got a king. Now, some of them were totally shocked by the kind of king they got. They thought they were going to get a guy on a white horse with a big sword. It's going to drive out all the Romans and lead them into a new empire. But the focus of the gospel was that it was a king. And that king had a kingdom, and being part of that kingdom meant that you could live right now as if the kingdom was already totally here. And that leads us ultimately to what it means to choose joy. Henry Nguyen says, joy doesn't simply happen to us. We have to choose joy and keep choosing it every day. The gospel to those early folks in the New Testament was that finally God had heard their cry, given them the Messiah, and now there was going to be this kingdom that they were going to be a part of, and it was going to change everything. It was going to change their lives now, but more importantly, it was going to set for them a future that they couldn't even imagine. It was going to be so great. And living towards that future, that made it easier to suffer. Richard Foster writes it a different way. He talks about the discipline of joy. The decision to set the mind on the higher things of life is an act of will. That's why celebration is a discipline. It's not something that falls on our heads. It's the result of consciously choosing a way of thinking and living. Some of the traditions that you shared around the table, some of them you're still hanging on to. Some of them disappeared. Why? Because somebody didn't hang on to them. You remember them, but they weren't important enough that you kept it going. That's sometimes what happens to certain traditions. And we get a little nostalgic about some of the things that happened back in the day, but somebody got tired of doing it and just quit, or somebody died and didn't do it anymore, and it wasn't carried on. It just ended. Because it takes effort. There's a discipline to celebration. You have to decide what you want to celebrate and whether it's worth celebrating and how to do it. And then somebody has to take the bull by the horns and keep doing it. We laugh in our family because Sandy's parents were kind of the matriarch, the patriarch. Then he died, and so my mother-in-law still sort of is holding the extended family together. But ultimately, when I and my brother-in-laws get together, we know very quickly she's 83, and the torch is going to be passed. What stays, what doesn't stay? What do you do with an ever-growing extended family? And sometimes you just give up. Nobody's house is big enough. Or do you all get together in a park? Some families have figured it out. It's important to them, and so they keep getting together. Other families say, you know what, we just outgrew getting together, and it's over, it's done. And so you start again with a smaller family. It takes effort. How do you have joy through all of life? How do we do that? There's two things that I want to suggest as we end this morning. One is ritual. And I described it this way. We find ways to habituate gratitude into our day and week. Habituate gratitude. I maybe should have thought of a less big word to say that, but it just sounded so cool in my mind, I had to put it up there. Habituate gratitude. You have to force yourself at times to be grateful. And you have to have habits that make you grateful. In our RVing stage of our life, my wife and I, my absolute habit was to figure out how to beat my wife out of bed in the morning by at least an hour and a half so that I could sit by myself, watch the sun come up, and enjoy that quiet time. That just became a habit, right? I just loved the solitude of being in a beautiful place, sitting there in my chair, maybe start a fire, have a cup of coffee in my hand, and just have my devotions, or just think gratitude. Absolutely refused to think of anything negative because I had another 352 days to do that. This week away, I was not going to do that. It's ritual. Having a routine helps us to focus and overcome negativity. Routines help if you're a person who falls into negative thoughts very, very easily. Special celebrations and events help to brighten our moods and connect us emotionally to gratefulness and gladness. Routine helps. Celebration helps. Routine helps. And that's why some of the traditions that you share around your table, they evoke special memories. It took someone to put some effort into that, but you enjoyed it. And it takes effort to keep that going. What works for you? The other one is redirection. When thoughts come about how bad your life is, how hard your life is, how unfair your life is, and we all got to admit, those can come a lot. You redirect your mind, which is best defined as directed attention to something you're grateful at. You know, we make fun of the song Count Your Blessings because it seems so silly simple. Silly simple. Trouble is it works. Because you have to redirect. If I suddenly say to you, right now you got to come up with 10 things that you're happy for. You know, oh man, because now you have to redirect your mind, right? A moment ago you're sitting there thinking, you know, I wish they'd made the coffee stronger, right? I wish the icing wasn't so bad for my heart. You were thinking all those negative things. When is Matt going to stop talking? You know, all those things. But the moment I say, you have to come up with 10 things that you're happy, right away your mind redirects, you forget some of the others, and you have to focus. That's just how our minds work. If you refocus attention on something, it snaps you out of whatever you're in. Redirecting our minds, directed attention, focusing even when you don't want to focus. I got up out of bed this morning. I could hear the wind. I'd already put my earplugs in around 6 a.m. And for a moment there, as the alarm went off, I thought, I don't want to do this. It's cold out there.
I have to walk all the way down the hill where I parked my...
There is a moment of you just... And I hate that. It's Sunday, and the first thought of my mind was, I hate this day. Whereupon I had to give myself a quick boot in the rear end. You miserable, lazy guy. Get out of bed. Get into that shower. Get into those warm clothes. Put on your boots and trudge down that hill because that's good for you. And you got to give yourself a stern talking to. Get out of that frame of mind. What are you talking about? Do you really think people are want to show up and have Matt sitting there going, oh, I'm so glad you all showed up this morning. I wish you hadn't, because then I wouldn't have to have this service. You don't want to hear a guy like that. God has given us ways to express our joy. Psalm 16 says it so wonderfully. You made known to me the path of life. You fill me with joy in your presence, with eternal pleasures at your right hand. And I leave you with this great quote from C.S. Lewis. Good things, as well as bad, you know, are caught by a kind of infection. If you want to get warm, you got to stand near the fire. If you want to be wet, you got to get into the water. If you want joy, power, peace, eternal life, you got to get close to or even into the thing that has them. They are not the sort of prize which God could, if he chose, just hand out to anyone. They're the great foundations of energy and beauty spurting up at the very center of reality. And if you're close to it, the spray will wet you. If you are not, you will remain dry. And who's the center? Jesus. The closer we get to him, the more the spray falls on us. You stand at the edge, you stand away. It's just kind of a religious thing that you do once in a while on a Sunday. You're not going to get very wet. It's not going to do much for you. Joy is basically getting close to the source of joy. It's God himself. God himself. Let's pray. Father, thank you that we can, on this fourth Advent, having gone through faith and hope and peace and now joy, we can understand that all these things are wrapped up in who you are. And you become the answer to those deep needs that we have to be able to live life at a level that gives us peace. Live life so that there's joy. Live life so that there's hope. Live life so that we can have this joy that comes through faith in you. Lord, you want to change our days. It's not that we can just accept one day after another and hope one day we get to heaven and that everything changes. That is one way to live. It's not the preferred way to live. You want us to see our days changed, and so that meaning and purpose and faith and hope and love is brought into our days, so that there is a natural progression, so that when we get to heaven, yes, it's perfection, but we took some of heaven back into our lives and we let that be expressed through us. We found heaven in the days that you gave us. We found the gratitude of heaven and the longing of heaven and the love of heaven. We found it in our days, in our daily activities, in the people around us, in family, in friends, in celebration, in tradition. Thank you, Lord, for Christmas time. Thank you for what we can do for each other, for our community, for you. Bless us as we gather on Christmas Eve and as we, as both our churches, express our joy to you for all that you are and all that you mean to us. Father, thank you. Thank you that being close to you puts us in the center of joy. And God's people said, amen.